what I'm finding is it's not the tools anymore that get in the way. I think it's some of the cultural sort of things that actually get in the way. It requires a total change of attitude.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and this is Future Proof. So, I'm excited to introduce you to Stephen Tomke, if you're not already familiar with his work. He's the acclaimed Harvard Business School professor who recently wrote Experimentation Works, The Surprising Power of Business Experiments. And he's studied business experimentation for years, which is why I thought it was so important to speak to him, given that COVID-19 has forced companies to embrace disruption like never before. In his book, Stephen argues that an organization's ability to innovate depends on constantly running business experiments, in some cases tens of thousands a year. He draws on original research and case studies in his book, so I thought this is really the perfect time to have him on the show. Quick note, we recorded the show about 2 weeks back as we were getting used to our remote studios, so you'll hear some minor background noise. Anyhow, I'll shut up and let Stephen take it away. So, Stephen, welcome to Future Proof.
Thanks for having me, Jeremy.
Yeah, no, I think that one of the things that I like to ask people just right off the bat is, you know, who the heck are you in your own words, and what do you do on a day-to-day basis?
I am an insanely curious person. My background is engineering, so I was trained as an engineer who later on got really interested in studying sort of innovation, the economics of innovation, innovation processes, and so forth. But I read a lot of things, a lot more than just business books. You know, I love science. I never get bored, so there's a lot going on.
Yeah, I think nice and sweet, short, and succinct. And I think that, you know, I really want to talk to you because obviously I just read Experimentation Works. And I think that it's so timely, right? Because right now, as we're speaking, people are racing to figure out how to even deal with the current pandemic out there, right? And I think that, you know, one thing that I had heard you talk about when we were talking offline that was so impactful to me is the failure to get testing capability up and running is such a critical issue in any crisis, right? Because it's something that allows you to reach a fruitful conclusion sooner rather than later, right? So can you go into that a little bit more? That's really interesting to me.
You know what's amazing, Jeremy? I've been writing and researching testing and experimentation for more than 25 years now. And in the last few weeks, I've seen more articles in the general media on testing than I've ever seen before. So testing seems to be the topic of the day. And again, I've been trying to draw attention to this for quite a long time so people understand the value of testing. And I think the value of testing is really front and center here. The ability to test people, whether they have COVID-19, and do it in a way that it's reliable. That is, you know, getting a low rate of false positive and false negatives. The ability to test for immunity, to get people back to work. All these things are critical for making decisions about public health, for making decisions about the economic recovery and so forth. So for someone who's been interested in studying testing for such a long time, it's shocking to me how inadequate sort of testing was as we were trying to ramp it up. You know, the delays that we faced, the actual approach to testing is not just about the number of tests, it's smart testing, you know, basically doing random sampling and all sorts of things. It almost seems like, you know, at least in the first few weeks that there was no testing strategy. And the question, of course, why is that? You know, we have pretty amazing people in this country, you know, biostatisticians, you know, healthcare professionals, some of the leading scientists in the world are here. But it seems to me that our political leadership was kind of asleep here and wasn't listening to the people sort of in the first few weeks. So we had a really slow start. Now things are being ramped up very quickly. I'm still not sure whether the data that we're getting is really what we need. You know, we seem to be running behind the curve. In fact, it's really hard to make these kinds of decisions without sort of the right data, without the right kinds of tests. So I think if anything, I mean, in addition to a public health crisis, I think we also have a data crisis, and that's going to be around for some time.
That's actually a really good point. In some ways, I think, the idea of having really useful data and also conducting useful experiments and searching for the right answers, that's really, like, you hit the nail on the head. I feel like that's what, whether or not it's governments trying to deal with a pandemic or corporations trying to do true innovation, that's really what you're after. I mean, and I know it's not necessarily your direct field, right? But what's an example of how you can start to be thinking about like a situation like a pandemic and thinking about how do we test for the right things? How do we, ramp up testing in order to identify the right variables and the right inputs?
Well, first of all, if you're trying to develop a test approach or a test strategy and infrastructure for testing, you ought to do that when you don't have a crisis, because then you have time to really think it through, to build it, because it takes some time. You need to build a culture that values testing. So there's a lot of work sort of to do, and to do that sort of in a crisis mode is very, very challenging, because you're always going to be sort of running behind the curve. Now, testing, of course, good testing strategies include having tests available. And so it took a long time for us to have the right number of tests available. I mean, if you compare, I think, us with South Korea, South Korea and the US has basically their first diagnosed case of COVID-19 almost on the same day. It's on January 20 and January 21. And that they were sort of running much, much faster. So first of all, you need to have good tests available. Then you also think about strategies, sort of going around and not just, testing the people who walk into a hospital, but also doing random sampling. You need to kind of know where it is. You need to know, what sort of the infection rates are and so on and so on. And so, I mean, we can go on and on. There are just so many different things you need to think about. And the reason why they're critical, because, we're now discussing, the possibility of relaxing, social distancing and things like that. And we have to figure out like for whom and where should it be done and all that. And you can't really do that unless you have good data available, because otherwise you're just going to put more people at risk. We're discussing, economic recovery. I mean, wouldn't it be great to have a test that can be done at large scale where you could actually tell people that they had the virus and so on? I mean, so there are lots of things.
Yeah, I think that it's interesting to me also that corporations in some ways can learn from this experience. Obviously, there are even politics that are a major issue inside, major organizations. But I think, one thing that you just hit the nail on the head for me is if you're trying to conduct tests, you need to be ahead of the curve versus behind it. And I think in some ways of companies like Blockbuster that maybe did not do enough testing and experimentation inside their company until a certain point where you're scrambling and you're so far behind. And when you're so far behind, that's a very difficult time to say, let's go fund a whole bunch of test and learns, right?
That's true, Jeremy. And what does innovation and the current crisis have in common? Well, they're both about uncertainty, and now we're actually facing extreme uncertainty. So how do we resolve uncertainty? Well, sort of traditionally, the way we resolve uncertainty in innovation is, we either rely on our experience, but often, of course, is when you're creating something really new, you may not have any experience to rely on. We can use big data and analytics. But again, same problem. If something is very novel, there's not a lot of data around, because if there was a lot of data around, it wouldn't be very novel. And so that leaves us with this notion of experiments or disciplined experiments that can actually help us to resolve some of that uncertainty.
Don't you think, and I was just kind of lost in thought as you're talking about that, I mean, don't you think that people have certain biases that inform the types of experiments that they want to run, or even trying to control the outcome? Because that's one thing that I found is that there are two types of people largely, the type that I just described and the type of people where the most important thing to them is to get to the truth, regardless of what the truth might be. So I don't know if you've encountered either of those archetypes, or if you disagree with the fundamental idea I'm bringing forth, please let me know.
No, I totally agree. And I run into people like that all the time. In fact, in the book, I write about an experimentation culture. And, and one of the elements of an experimentation culture is curiosity. It's, everyone in an organization from the leadership down needs to value surprises, and they need to have that mindset. When you have that mindset, then curiosity will prevail and people will see failures not as costly mistakes, but as opportunities for learning. So if you don't value that, if you don't value surprises, if you don't value sort of getting to the truth, it's never going to work. And so that's really important. And so you got to keep that in mind as you're sort of thinking about sort of building an environment like that.
How about when you're talking about building an environment like this? And this is something that I struggled with when I was running my agency and even when I was on the brand side is, you know, I loved, from a personal edification standpoint, I just loved running experiments, you know? I wanted to be constantly running business experiments in whatever department I was in. And the reality is you've got to balance all types of corporate initiatives, including hitting your numbers now. And then in my mind, the experimentation is all about hitting your numbers in the midterm and in the long term. It's doing things that you've got some data and so that you can be smarter than the next guy who didn't run those types of experiments. But how do you draw a balance between those two things?
Well, first of all, you need to understand that experimentation is about learning. So there needs to be a learning objective here. You know, if you're not interested in learning, if you're not curious, if you've already made up your mind about a decision, then what's the point of running the experiment? So I think that's first. The second element I think is also important when you're trying to build a culture like that is, you know, one of the elements need to be that you insist that data actually trump opinions. This goes back to what you mentioned earlier, Jeremy. When you have that culture of culture, you know, people will only run experiments when the experiments actually prevail in most of the cases, and even when they clash with strong opinions, no matter whose opinions they are. And unfortunately, we tend to happily accept good results, which are basically the kinds of results that confirm our biases, but challenge and thoroughly investigate bad results, which are things that go against our assumptions. So again, I think the culture is really, really important. Building that kind of culture and leadership in this culture matters a lot because the signals are coming from the top.
How about when you think about experiments? Okay, how big or small are we talking? Is there any validity to saying the ideal experiment is a certain size, or is there really no way to quantify? Because, you know, again, in my experience, I've felt that sometimes you can do very small experiments that can be very impactful in the long run. But is there an example kind of like of a small experiment that, you know, has had a big impact, and even how many experiments should an organization be running?
You know, some of the leading organizations who are really big into this, I mean, when you look at companies like, you know, the Amazons and Microsoft and Booking.com, Facebook and so forth, you know, they run tens of thousands of experiments a year. Many of these experiments are actually quite small, but even the small experiments can have a huge impact. There was one example that I'm describing in the book of a Microsoft employee actually testing a very small idea. It only took a few days actually of setting it up. And when he ran it, it increased revenue by an astonishing 12%. So that's more than $100 million of additional revenue per year in the United States alone. That's kind of amazing, right? And the reason why that works is in an online environment, a digital environment, which is, you know, where we're all heading, you can scale things instantly, and you can often scale it to tens or hundreds of millions of people. So small things in these kinds of environments can make a big difference. And the impact at the end, the big impact is often, you know, the sum of all the small changes, you know, they all accumulate. And so we need to really appreciate, I think, if anything, sort of the age that we're sort of heading into now, the digital age, if anything, I think small experiments are even more valuable than some of the large things that we're aiming for. I call it high velocity incrementalism. So you got to do a lot of these small things, but you got to do it at sort of at very, very high speed. So that's really powerful. And so there are lots of examples around, you know, I have a number of them in the book as well. And I think that's changing.
I think that there's something to what you said, which is really true, is that the idea of having all of these small changes that you can iterate on your product very quickly or your customer experience very quickly because of these web technologies that allow you to do this type of incrementalism that works really well. And I mean, to me, it seems like it's one of those things where the technology is there. So what are some of the reasons that companies just don't embrace experimentation? I've certainly been parts of cultures and advised companies that completely get it. And then I've seen some where, for whatever reason, there's just a lot of objection towards running an experiment in the first place.
You're absolutely right, you know, that the tools are getting pretty good. You know, it used to be that companies had to build their own tools, had to build their own infrastructure, but now there are third-party tools available to do this. So what I'm finding is it's not the tools anymore that get in the way. I think it's some of the cultural sort of things that actually get in the way. It requires a total change of attitude. So it requires the kinds of things that I just mentioned. You know, you have to cultivate curiosity. You need to insist that data trump opinions. But you need to also democratize experiments. You need to empower people in an organization to run these experiments without having to kind of to run it up sort of the corporate chain to get permission. You need create sort of an environment that's totally transparent. You need to create an organization where people are ethically sensitive about the experiments that they run. And then, of course, you need to, again, comes back to this leadership model, this new leadership model that you sort of need to run. And that requires a very different role for senior leaders. You know, if a lot of the decisions are now, good decisions are made with the help of experiments, you may wonder sort of what exactly is the role of a senior leader in an environment like this. And I've identified a number of different roles in the book for senior leaders, which can be actually quite challenging for them.
How about, this is one thing that I was kind of thinking about, is in my mind, there are certain places within the organization, and please correct me if I'm wrong, certain places in the organization where just experimentation lends itself more naturally and certain places where it just doesn't quite work as well for whatever reason. So in your research, have you found that it inherently lends itself well to certain parts of the organization more than others?
Yes, it's a great question, Jeremy. So I've looked at experiments in all kinds of settings, online settings, in brick and mortar settings, in business-to-business settings, and in B2C settings as well. And I have examples from all these settings in the book. It turns out that you can run experiments in all these settings. Of course, the online setting lends itself sort of more towards this. You have more tools, you're direct with customers, you have a lot more traffic, so you can achieve a concept which we call statistical power sort of more easily. There are a lot of things that that favor that, but that doesn't mean that you cannot run these in brick and mortar settings. In fact, companies run these experiments, disciplined experiments, in brick and mortar settings. In R&D as well, my first book that I wrote in 2003 was all about experimentation in R&D in product development settings as well. Where the tools, where they've come up with amazing tools as well. Yes, so there's some areas where it's a little easier than others, but it really affects everything.
No, I mean, I think it certainly does. And I think that, you know, another thing that is also important to keep in mind is that there are certain cultures that consistently get this right. There are some that don't and then fall by the wayside. I mean, are there certain companies, I know you talk about this a bit in the book, where they've just had this type of culture that encourages experimentation that are worth taking a look at for anybody who's interested in promoting that type of culture, you know, inside their organization?
Well, I have a number of different examples. One example of an organization that's really far on their journey is Booking.com. They've done this for a long time. Amazon is one of these companies as well. And in fact, I have a whole chapter where we take a deep dive into Booking.com and try to understand, you know, both sort of the culture, try to understand the processes that they've set up, how they've actually organized for this, where we look at the role of their senior leaders in this environment. And so, yes, the reader can learn about this in a lot of sort of nitty-gritty details. So this is not just top-level stuff and how this can be done, but I also have examples of organizations that have just started on this journey as well and explain sort of how they go through the different stages as well.
Getting back to things, I think that, you know, as we were talking about online experimentation, I can't help but, you know, go back to the time that we're talking where brick and mortar is so incredibly disrupted. And I know that you've covered experimentation within brick and mortar, but for the companies of, you know, I know when you wrote the book, we didn't know the world that we'd be living in right now. And are there any types of, you think, experiments that brick and mortar retailers in particular, and really, like, let's expand that to every type of business that's been massively impacted, are there types of experiments that they can run, you know, in the interim while they're disrupted or even afterwards in order to better improve customer experience and, you know, just fuel future growth?
Yes, for sure. They can run experiments today. They can run it in their stores. I'll give you an example. Kohl's, you know, the big retailer, has been running experiments in their stores. Walmart actually runs experiments in their stores. So when I mean experiments, I don't mean not just they're not trying things. I mean, these are very disciplined activities, you know, with controls and everything. And so here's an example. So Kohl's did an interesting analysis and, you know, it was suggested that they can decrease the operating costs if they open their stores an hour later from Monday through Saturday. And, you know, anybody can do this analysis. You know, it's easy to calculate how much cost you can save and so forth. But the question of the day that back then was, but what is it going to do to revenue? Now, if you don't test, if you don't run experiments, you know, as an executive, it's really a leap of faith. You have to go out and you just have to open all the stores an hour later and see what happens. Or maybe you take a few of the stores and open an hour later and see what happens. But they decided that the way to get an answer to that question was to run rigorous experiments. So they picked about 100 of their stores with controls and actually ran it for a while and then learned that it would not result in any meaningful sales decline. What it does then is when you can run these experiments, it gives then executives or even sort of middle management the courage to be bold, you know, to take these kinds of leaps, you know, when you're trying to make changes to your system. In the absence of experiments, how would you make these kinds of decisions? You know, you just have to follow your gut. And, you know, what we've learned, you know, if anything, you know, we're wrong most of the time. In fact, when I was looking at various companies, there was one constant that kept on coming up, and that is they all told me that we found when we're running experiments, we are wrong about 8 to 9 out of 10 times. And so getting it wrong or failing, that's the normal operating mode here. So retail, everywhere, you can do this today. There are actually good tools available to do this as well.
How about, you know, even when you're thinking about, like, from an industry-to-industry standpoint, I know you mentioned booking.com. I think that, I mean, in my opinion, and this is just totally not supported by anything, but considering there are certain industries where the margins are greater, you know, maybe people get a little bit lazier and they don't necessarily do as much, but I would think that organizations or industries where there are very, very small margins, it's incredibly beneficial and important for them to be running experimentation on an ongoing basis just to ensure that they survive.
For sure. But in Booking.com's case, by the way, their margins are very high. You know, their gross profit there is in the 90s percentages. So, you know, they take 15% on average out of every transaction that's booked. So, in fact, I think even in the environments where margins are really high, I mean, the upside is even greater. I gave you the example of Microsoft. Imagine now that the employee had never run the test. So, you know, Microsoft would have never known that making that change would result in an additional $100 million of revenue. So that's the power. Kind of what made the difference? Well, the difference is that this employee could just run a test and see what works and what doesn't work. So having that capability is huge.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's something I've believed in for a long time. I think it's a better way of figuring out what's going to dominate the next few years if you do this type of experimentation. And I think hopefully some of our listeners are going to embrace it or make a newly impassioned case for it after listening to this. But yeah, thank you so much, Stefan. This has been, I feel like, really, really helpful to me and to our listeners.
Thanks, Jeremy, and thanks for having me. Maybe I just want to close with one quote that I really loved is William Gibson, you know, the speculative fiction writer. You know, the future's already here. It's just not very evenly distributed. I think keep that in mind as you're thinking about experimentation. A lot of companies are already doing this.
Amen to that. Thank you.
Hey, thanks. Yeah.
So hopefully you guys enjoyed that conversation half as much as I did. And I really think that the idea of business experimentation in the time of crisis, like we kind of are in right now, is so critical because the companies that embrace experimentation and adapt and learn from data are the ones that are going to stick around for a while, you know, hopefully years to come. So if you like what you just heard and this is your first time here, be sure to subscribe. Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, the choice is yours. And if you're a longtime listener, please remember to rate and review Future Proof, as that is the number one way we get the show in front of people just like you. Special thanks this week to associate producers Jason Stack and V. Cortuccio. Once again, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and you've been listening to Future Proof.